Good morning, church.
Good morning.
Or at least part of the church. Oh, wait. Well, this morning we're starting a new series. I should have grabbed my book from the office and show you what it looks like, but we're starting a new book. And the text that it's over sorry, the internet is down and I wasn't able to print this out before I got up here, so I'm trying to figure out the digital copy of my notes. Okay. I think we're good. Yeah, so this morning we're starting a new series, new book, Living Life Backward by David Gibson, which, yeah, the title's up there, going over chapter 1. The text is Ecclesiastes 1, 1 through 11. And we're using the book for this series, but I don't want us to see this series as a study over the book, but rather a study over Ecclesiastes, over the biblical text. So David Gibson, he's the author of the book that we're using, but what I want for and envision this series to be is a guide, or what I envision the book to be is a guide in our study of Ecclesiastes. So not just looking at the book, and I primarily want to see us as using Gibson's text as a guide to that end. So, in using Gibson, I'll just quote him as describing what he sees as the main point of the book of Ecclesiastes, okay? Before I do that, I forgot to pray, so I'm going to pray, and then we'll get into it. Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for the gift of your people that your body is to the rest of your body. I ask that you would give us grace to see and to hear and to understand this morning, that we would interpret your text well, that you would keep me from error, keep me humble, and that you would cause us through a greater understanding and love of your word to be faithful doers of that word. And that you'd bless the rest of our time this morning in our service and worship to you in the same way. We ask this in your son's precious name. Amen. Okay. So, helpful point that Gibson brings out about the book of Ecclesiastes in his book, that I think is a helpful starting point. He says, "I am convinced that only a proper perspective on death provides the true perspective on life." Proper perspective on death provides the true perspective on life. Living in light of your death will help you to live wisely and freely and generously. It will give you a big heart, open hands, and enable you to relish all the small things of life in deeply profound ways. And he ends with, "Death can teach you the meaning of mirth." So, where does Gibson learn this perspective, right? He explains, Ecclesiastes teaches us how to live life backward. Title of the book. It encourages us to take one thing in the future that is certain, that is our death, and work backward from that point into all the details and decisions and heartaches and everything of our lives, and to think about them from the perspective of the end. It is the destination that makes sense of the journey. And if we know for sure where we're heading, then we can know for sure what we need to do before we get there. So, Ecclesiastes invites us, this is still Gibson, Ecclesiastes invites us to let the end sculpt our priorities and goals, our greatest ambitions, and our strongest desires. Ecclesiastes wants to persuade you that only if you prepare to die can you really learn how to live. So that's the scope of what we're going to cover in Ecclesiastes. And in my opinion, Gibson becomes pretty convincing on that point. But now what I want to do is mention something about the author of Ecclesiastes itself before we actually jump into the text. So the author identifies himself in the first verse as the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Okay? And that seems pretty convincing that the author is who he says he is, David's son, King Solomon, king in Jerusalem, right? But scholars have argued the uncertainty of that fact by pointing to things like the fact that he uses the title preacher, Koheleth, which means it means assembler. And so they'll argue that the author is merely an assembler of Solomon's words. So Solomon may have a role in authorship, but only indirectly. And also the fact that Solomon kind of hides behind the pseudonym of the preacher and doesn't just name himself outright. And I'm going to say that's a fine orthodox position to hold, but I'd respond to that with what seems to be clear to me, that he doesn't seem to be hiding at all. In that introduction, that first verse. I also think there's a lot of verses in the book that appear pretty indicative of Solomon's life as a whole. So like chapter 1, verse 16, he said, I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And chapter 2, verse 4, I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. And then chapter 12, 9, besides being wise, and this switches to the third person, but we'll take it as evidence anyway. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. So, I feel like it's dangerous to disagree with a lot of scholars who know a lot about about the Old Testament than I do. We may not be able to say with certainty that Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes, but to me, there's more sufficient evidence to say that he did than that he didn't. So, for much the same reason that I call Paul the author of Hebrews, I'll refer to the author of Ecclesiastes as Solomon for the rest of the time. And that's not David Gibson's position. That's just me. So, my personal view. So, let's start. Do I need to point this thing at that? It works. Let's start at the beginning. So I'd like to read Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, which is the text that informs chapter 1 of Gibson's book. So Ecclesiastes 1 says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. The vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams lead to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, 'See, this is new'? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Okay, so we really can't understand what Solomon is teaching us until we understand his favorite word, okay? That is vanity. What does it mean to say that everything is vanity? English translations are going to often translate this Hebrew word hebel as vanity or meaningless. And when you talk about something as vain or being meaningless, what does that typically invoke? Futility, hopelessness. So when Solomon says, in my opinion, Solomon says that all is vain, all is meaningless, what do you do with that? That everything is literally hopeless or futility? Literally everything? Which would make the word meaninglessness a meaningless word? You despair. Okay, so I think you do, when you use the word vain or meaninglessness, kind of uncontextually, you do get that sense of the word, right? Exactly. Thank you, Art. Yes, thank you. You're getting ahead of me now. So, in this case, we would say, if that's the case about what Solomon's point is, we would say that there's really no point to the world or the universe or anything, and thus there is no purpose to life at all or for writing the book of Ecclesiastes at all, right? So, what is Ecclesiastes intending to communicate by that word? Gibson is helpful here. He points out that the Hebrew word for vanity or meaninglessness that the ESV translates as meaninglessness is hebel, and it has a wider semantic range than just vanity. That word hebel gets translated generally in the Old Testament in really two ways. The first meaning is what you find in the ESV, and that's meaninglessness or vanity, which, as we're going to see, does not really communicate hopelessness or complete futility, at least, or complete despair. The other translation you often see is something like vapor or breath or wind. So other places in the Old Testament where this word has been translated as breath is Psalm 144 in verse 3. O Lord, what is man that you regard him? Or the son of man that you think of him? Man is like a hevel, a breath. And then the psalmist commentates on that. His days are like a passing shadow, temporary. Interestingly, in Psalm 39, verse 5 through 6, we get both uses of the word hevel in the psalm. Behold, you have made my days a few handbreadths, and my lifetime is as nothing before you. Surely all mankind stands as a mere hevel, a mere breath. So that's the first sense, a breath, vapor, temporary, transient. Surely a man goes about as a shadow. Surely for hevel, for nothing, for vanity, they are in turmoil. So there's the second meaning you get there. Man heads up wealth and does not know who will gather. When you discipline a man with rebukes for sin, you consume like a moth what is dear to him. Surely all mankind is a mere breath, hevel. So you see those two meanings in the Old Testament. And if we take into account the full semantic range of that word and apply it to the first few verses of Ecclesiastes, it could say something like this, right? The merest of breaths, says the preacher. The merest of breaths. Everything is a breath. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes. So verse 3 seems like a commentary on that first meaning, meaninglessness, vanity. And then verse 4 seems like a commentary on the other meaning. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Now, That's what I want to communicate. I don't want to communicate that only one meaning is involved there. I think Solomon wants to communicate both the meaninglessness of life and the brevity of life under the sun. But notice what he's not saying, as Art pointed out earlier. He's not saying that everything is meaningless, as in there's no point to anything at all. Right? I think Solomon wants to show us that we are here on this earth for a very brief period of time. And that because we're only given a short time amount of time to live here, we must see gain in this life as futile. So Solomon picks up this idea of gain being futile and our lives being a breath. Elsewhere in the book, it's really a theme through the whole book. You get it in chapter 1, verse 14, chapter 1, verse 17, chapter 2, verse 11, chapter 2, verse 17, and 2, 26. It just keeps going and going and picks up on this concept. So, with this understanding of Ecclesiastes, that life is both meaningless in the sense that Solomon means it, and is brief, is a breath, what are some conclusions you could draw from the first few verses of the book? Or really the first two verses. Yeah, I mean, I think all of those are valid conclusions for the fact that, for understanding that life is temporary here, and we will all be dead very soon. Right? Gibson, in the book, Living Life Backward, he's helpful here, and he gets more specific and points out five conclusions that Solomon intends to teach in Ecclesiastes 1, or at least that first part of chapter 1. So, I keep pointing at the screen. It's the projector. This is what he offers. Life, from the first few verses, life is short, elusive, and repetitive. So we must prepare to die and therefore learn to live. Okay, so I want to take those in turn as we walk through the first 11 verses of Ecclesiastes, that life is short, elusive, repetitive, and because of those things, we must prepare to die well, and therefore we learn to live well. So first, life is short. One minute you're here, next minute you're gone. But why, or we kind of already answered this question, why is the fact that life is short, how would that teach you how to live now? And so we already gave answers to that question, so we don't have to go over that again. But one of the things that I do want to ask is, all of us in this room, I'll preface the question, all of us in this room are believers, and we answered that question based on the fact that we live in light of eternity, right? As Ecclesiastes teaches us to do, rightly. But what if you're an unbeliever? What does the brevity of life do for you then? Yeah, you got to put something in your life first. It's either, if you're a believer, it's going to be God. If you're not, it's going to be whatever in the world else you can find. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Again, all valid. Which makes sense, because this is a smart group who knows their Bible well. Don't expect any bad answers in here. So I think that Ecclesiastes shows us that the brevity of life is the reason for why we can make... Ecclesiastes shows us that the brevity of life allows us to make no lasting impact on the world. The brevity of life allows us to make no lasting impact on the world. There's nothing here that we do, in a general sense, that truly matters in the end. Because, and I'm talking about on the earth, in a temporal sense, right? In an earthly sense. There's nothing here that we do that truly matters, because a generation comes and a generation goes. And then the next one comes. And then the next one comes. And the one after that, before that, goes. And the one before that goes. And so on and so on. Right? I had a college professor who liked to illustrate this point by asking everyone in the room to raise their hand if they could name 4 out of their 8 great-grandparents. And out of like 150 people in the room, maybe 10 could raise their hand. So think about yourself. Could you name 4, half of your 8 great-grandparents? I assume that in this room, there's probably more of us who could do that than a room full of 18 to 21-year-olds. But even much more than their names, if that's at least partly true, how much less could we say anything else about their life? Like, where were they born? Where did they work? Were they rich? Were they poor? Were they a good husband? Were they a good father? Were they a good wife? Good mother? Were they a believer? Did they go to church? Like, life is so short, right? And the next generation will know you, but another 80 years, and the one after that knows a name, and because of the abundance of technology today, they'll have a face with pictures. And then you've got a slim chance that the generation after that even knows you ever existed. So like we said, Ecclesiastes is teaching us how to live based on the fact that life is short, and others, which leads us to the second one that Gibson points out. The second conclusion is really just a derivative of that first one, and that's the fact that life is elusive. So Gibson says, life is a bit of smoke. It's temporary, it's transient, it's a vapor, it's a breath. But the smoke in front of your eyes is not just transient, it is also elusive. Try to grab the smoke. Try to put it in your pocket and keep it for later. If we try to gain control of our own world by what we can understand and by what we can do, we find that the control that we seek over our lives very quickly eludes us. So in some ways we're able to understand how the world works, and in some measure we can control our environment, but never completely. Because if we could, that would make us God. It rains on days that you don't bring your umbrella. It's the line that you join, that you don't join at the grocery store is always the fastest line. You feel depressed for absolutely no reason at all on some days. Even more, people you know and love die and suffer young, while the wicked person prospers even into old age. It just doesn't make sense, right? There are things that are outside of our control and that it doesn't make sense to us a lot of the time. But it's not even control of life in a bad sense, right? Sometimes the control we try to maintain is just ordinary. So you pour an insane amount of hard work into your job. And it might succeed. You might succeed in that. Or no matter how hard you might try, it might just fail despite doing everything right. You might land a big job and the bank might shut down the next day. You never know what's going to happen. How much control do you really have over your own job security? How much control do you really have over your own health? What's going to happen to interest rates and house prices? Who will you meet in 10 years' time? Where are you going to be living in 10 years' time? You know, I think we always tend to think, not always, most of us tend to think that the bad things are never going to happen to us, right? Somebody else is going to get the cancer. Somebody else is going to get in a car wreck. We think, and we build the illusion for ourselves a lot of the time, that we can build security here, financial security, bodily security, job security, but you just can't know what's going to happen in an ultimate sense. You are ultimately not in control, and that doesn't mean that it's wrong to build security for unexpected events. The Lord just wants to teach us through Ecclesiastes that as soon as you think that you've got something secure, and you've built something for yourself here, whether it's a house or a legacy, whatever it is, as soon as you do, then you've missed the point of what Ecclesiastes is trying to teach, right? So in this book, Solomon wants to correct that way of living and teach us that it is not so. So in Ecclesiastes 1 verse 3, Solomon asks a question. Chapter 1 verse 3, he says, "What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun?" And he implies an answer to that question. And what is that answer? What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Nothing. Yeah. Easy. The implied answer to the question in verse 3 is nothing. That's what he wants us to see. So when you work, what are you doing? You know, like Disney would like us to think that we're working because we love it and you should never do anything unless you love it. But ultimately, what we're doing in our jobs is we're working to gain something. It's not purely for the enjoyment of it. We work to gain something so that we can have something left over, even if it's not towards, or even especially if it's not towards selfish ends. We work to provide for our families or to make house payments or to do whatever, go on vacation and bless our children with a fun ski trip, whatever it would be. When you do a profession or a job, sometimes joy is that byproduct, but in the end, you expect to get something in return that you earned, that you can keep. And Solomon says that in the end, you keep nothing. You gain nothing in the end. You cannot hold on to and control what you have. So Solomon is asking us, at the end of your life, what will be left over? What, if anything, will count in your favor as a monument to your legacy? As a monument to your effort on earth? You know, maybe if you're... Some of y'all will be familiar with this name. Seth, you know this name. If you're Donald W. Reynolds, you know, you might have a stadium named after you. But in the end, 100 years from now, is anybody going to know that name? That's an OSU reference. Not everybody got that. So in all our work in this life and in this earth, we haven't altered a single thing about how the rest of the earth and the rest of people's lives after us will go. The earth is going to continue to spin, and humanity and the earth will still be just as it was when Abraham walked the earth. So that's the second conclusion, that life is elusive. The third conclusion from the first few verses of Ecclesiastes, and the one that Ecclesiastes spends the most time on in these verses, is that life is repetitive. So after we come to verse 3, we see verses 4 through 10. And verses 4 through 10 is intended to be an illustration to the question in verse 3. The world just keeps on going on as it always has. Let's read Ecclesiastes 4, chapter 1, verse 4 through 10. "A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises again. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind. And on its circuits, the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. So, I think what Solomon is observing about life wisely and accurately observing about life is that people want to break that cycle. That's verse 7. Yeah, they want to break this cycle of going over and over and over again. They want to find something in their lives that will truly be completely new. And that in the newness, in the excitement of what is new, they will find significance. But, as Solomon points out, it is vanity to do so. So people want to search for something that they can say, look, no one's ever done this before. No one's ever been this before. In all the history of the world, we've never seen anything like this. But nothing like that, nothing that can hit that category has ever been in all the time under the sun. Whatever we see and everything we hear has already been done in some sense, right? The excitement of newness always fails at some point. And you need something else that's newer or better or more upgraded to scratch that itch. You know, the world records continue to get broken. Someone always makes more money. The house is always bigger. The next frontier is always explored. The morality keeps getting pushed further and further and further towards insanity. The technology continues just to improve all the time. But it's I think what Solomon intends to communicate is that it's all just a charade. Nothing is ever truly new, at least in the way that we experience it. So if anything is actually new on earth, surely if anything is new, we could say it's our technology, right? Like before 2008, when had anyone on the planet ever heard of a supercomputer that you could walk around with in your pocket? Surely that's something new, right? That's something that's never been seen before. That may be, but Solomon's point is not that there's nothing that has yet been seen to have ever come on the earth. It's not that there's anything literally new. Like at some point, Adam had to make the first fire on the planet. Or maybe God did when he put the angel with the flaming sword at the gate. It's not that there's nothing new that ever happens, but there's nothing that can possibly be found to break the repetitive cycle of the world and our lives that will satisfy the craving for something more. Nothing will ever satisfy that craving. Nothing like that can be found under the sun. And so, to find meaning in the repetitiveness of life, and to find meaning in the things that you do over and over and over again, like the dishes get dirty after you eat on them. The laundry keeps getting dirty. There's another dirty diaper to change. There's another house project. And every single one you do that you find satisfaction in only begs for something more. And so you have to look beyond the sun. Right? That's basically describe my own life, right? So, we see that we're supposed to view life as short and elusive and repetitive. So what? That's just how life is. Do you conclude then that everything is truly vain as a result? What are you supposed to do with that? You do. Absolutely. Yeah, that is. And I think that's what leads the unbeliever to say, as Seth said, or at least I think Seth said, either you despair and everything truly is meaningless, and you die, and you're buried in the dirt, and that's it. Or you live life up and you take every amount of pleasure you can in this life to fill up whatever is lacking. John, you got something? Oh man, you're jumping ahead now. Yep.
But that's
yeah. Yeah. I love it. Exactly. And I think that's where, as believers, I think you did jump ahead, but I appreciate it. No, that's great. I think what that is for the believer is a call to prepare to die, to prepare for the end. And not just for death itself, not just that we look forward to existing no more on this earth, but we look forward to exactly what John was saying, right? That we look forward to a thing to come, and that informs the way we live now. So, how? How do you prepare to die? Many people have interpreted Ecclesiastes as saying that the dissatisfaction with which one views life is only from a secularist perspective. And so what you need to do is get saved, and now you're able to enjoy life because your satisfaction is secure in Christ. I think that's part of what Solomon is trying to communicate, but what I want to suggest is that these verses are not giving a picture of what life is like without Christ. Verses 4 through 10, not giving a picture of what life is like without Christ. But it's just giving a picture of what the world is like. Period. The Christian can sympathize with the atheist that life is a breath, and the world never seems to stop. So being a Christian doesn't make the fact that life is a breath and the world is repetitive not true. It makes, as Gibson suggests, it should make us the first to stop pretending that it isn't true. Does that make sense? So that's the preacher's, that's what I see is the preacher's aim. He's carefully laying the foundation for the main argument of his book, that preparing ourselves for our inevitable death will teach us how to live. The significant aspect of Solomon's preparation for us is simply to recognize, right now, this morning at least, is simply to recognize that we live in a world where we will soon be dead. And we will take nothing with us, and the world will continue to go on and spin on after us. And so that's how we come to understand what it means to truly live. He wants the consequences, this is Gibson, he wants the consequences of our fast approaching disappearance from the earth to work their way into all the realities of the way we see the world and the way we view ourselves within the world. The single question that animates him is, if we won't live forever or even long enough to make a lasting difference in the world, how then should we live? And so Solomon takes the rest of Ecclesiastes to answer that question. So he doesn't flesh all that out in verses 1 through 11. And it might be dissatisfactory, or it might be bad teaching to do so, but I'm not going to either. And we're going to let Ken next week and me the week after that and so on and so forth kind of flesh it out as we go through the series. I'd like to leave us, though, where the text leaves us. So I want to hit on right now, what I want to hit on is to accept the fact that we will die soon, maybe unexpectedly, maybe expectantly. But the fact of the matter is, no matter how old you are, I think it will come sooner than you think. And in recognizing that fact, we then learn how to live. So again, we'll get more practical as the series goes on, but just for now, verses 1 through 11, life is short, life is elusive, life is repetitive. You will die. Let that teach you how to live. We're dismissed. Till service.